Okay. So today, in our continuing Akedah saga, which we are almost done with, but I suspect we'll take this and the next session to finish. Today we're going to start with literary analysis, which we have not done yet. And that will embrace two separate components. The first will be a brief reading from a book called Mimesis by a literary critic named Eric Auerbach, who is a German-Jewish literary critic who wrote this in exile with almost no books around him. And he, throughout the book, only the first chapter of which is about the Bible, the rest is about Western literature. I'm told that he quoted much of what he quoted from memory, and by the way, in several different languages, in French, in German. They used to make them like that. They don't so much anymore. Anyway, in the first chapter of this book, and Mimesis is about how literature represents reality, okay? That's the study of how different ways in which literature represents the world. The first chapter of the book is called Odysseus's Scar. You don't have to write that down, I'm just telling you. And he talks about, at the beginning, he says, readers of the Odyssey will remember the well-prepared and touching scene in book 19, when Odysseus has at last come home, the scene in which the old housekeeper who's been his nurse recognizes him by the scar on his thigh, right? Odysseus is an old man. Well, he's not that old, actually. He's young enough still to defeat all the suitors, but he's been away for a long time, and there's some very beautiful scenes when Odysseus comes home after the war in Troy. Remember, there's the Iliad, which is the war, then the Odyssey, which is his coming home, and the two people that recognize him right off are his old nurse who bathed him when he was a child because she sees the scar, and also his dog. And that's actually one of the most beautiful scenes in Homer, is his dog realizes that he's come home and dies at his feet. It's really very touching. It's amazing sometimes how an animal's suffering, I mean, a lot of people die in the Iliad and the Odyssey, and everybody remembers the dog. But I think the reason that that's so is that the dog is helpless. Human beings we don't think of as helpless, but animals in this case we think of as helpless. Anyway, that's tangential. So, no sooner has the old woman touched the scar than to her joyous surprise she lets Odysseus's foot drop into the basin. The water spills over. She's about to cry out her joy. Odysseus restrains her with whispered threats and endearments. She recovers and conceals her emotion. Penelope, whose attention Athena's foresight had diverted from the incident, has observed nothing. Now, why does he bring this up? Because he says, here is the way Homer describes action. It's all foreground. It's right there. He tells you everything, even what Odysseus' scar looks like. And then he's going to contrast that with the Bible, and in particular with the Akedah. But think about it in terms of the Bible in general. We don't know what anyone looks like, much less their scars. I mean, we know Saul was tall. That's about it, right? But our image of what biblical heroes looks like is entirely fabricated because the Bible doesn't do that. He says, all this is scrupulously externalized and narrated in a leisurely fashion. And then he goes on to describe how leisurely it is. And he talks more about Homer, and then comes to the Akedah after a long discourse on Homer. He says, this becomes clearer if we turn to the other person in the dialogue, to Abraham. Where is he? We do not know. He says, here I am, but the Hebrew word doesn't indicate the actual place where Abraham is, right? It's a moral position in respect to God who's called to him. Here I am, awaiting your command. And then he compares it to Homer again. And then he says, you know, everybody knows the story. I don't have to tell you, but he does, of course. But I don't have to tell this class. Then he goes on to say, where is it? The scriptures do not, like Homer, court our favor. They don't flatter us, that they may please and enchant us. They seek to subject us, and if we refuse to be subjected, we are rebels. In other words, Homer's trying to tell you a story and get you interested. The Bible is more like a hammer. It's kind of this happened and this happened and then he did this and God said that. And you're supposed to subordinate yourself to the story in the text. And that's why he says in part, the Bible doesn't go into all the various details that Homer does, because the idea here is not to, it's not a fireside story. It is a cryptic tale in which there's very little detail, in which we don't know what the characters did or what they thought. And it's almost like those paintings that are the barest outline, in which you're supposed to fill in the essence of it, but you know basically what the artist had in mind by the few strokes. While the reality of the Old Testament presents itself as a complete truth with a claim to sole authority, on the other hand, that very claim forces it to a constant interpretive change, for in millennia it undergoes an incessant and active development with the life of human beings. In other words, since it says this is the truth, and it has to interact with life, which continues to change, it forces you to interpret it. Since Homer doesn't say you have to believe everything that Odysseus did is good, you don't have to keep reinterpreting Odysseus to prove that he's good. But you've noticed how often we've reinterpreted Abraham already in these few sessions. Why? Because Abraham is good. So we have to figure out how the Akedah works so that Abraham is good, which means that we have to go through endless pages of interpretation, because otherwise the story's wrong. And you can't just walk away in this tradition and say, well, the Bible just told us a story about a bad man. And so Auerbach points out the very different ways in which we usually tell stories from the way in which we approach. And here's his contrast. We've compared two texts, and with them, the two kinds of style they embody, in order to reach a starting point for an investigation into literary representation of reality in European culture. That's what he cares about. Here are the two styles, okay? And you can tell which is which, I hope. On the one hand, fully externalized description, uniform illumination, that is, Homer gives equal description to everything, you know? It's not just he concentrates on this and doesn't care about that. Uninterrupted connections, free expression, all events in the foreground, displaying unmistakable meanings, you know what Homer means, few elements of historical development and psychological perspective. If you think, in other words, when Achilles begins the story of the Iliad, and he's angry, and he ends the story of the Iliad, he hasn't really grown very much. It's the same impetuous superhero as it was at the beginning. Not true of biblical characters. On the other hand, now here's the biblical characters. Certain parts brought into high relief, others left obscure. Abruptness, suggestive influence of the unexpressed. Sometimes it's what's not said that's most powerful in the Bible. Background quality. It all feels like there's a lot that happened in the background that we don't know about or aren't told about. Multiplicity of meanings and need for interpretation, as we've seen, lots and lots of meanings. Universal historical claims. Development of the concept of the historically becoming. That is, you always have a sense that something is emerging out of this. We know Abraham's not the end of the story. Whereas the Iliad and the Odyssey, you know, you sort of can cut it off. The story doesn't end, it just sort of gets stopped. And preoccupation with the problematic. The Bible is much more interested in troublesome things than it is in clear and sweet things. So I bring this up because because most of us tend to hear stories without thinking about the shape of the story that we're hearing. And we think, okay, there's a story about Abraham, and there's the movie I saw last week. But the way that, I'm not saying we give them equal weight, but we don't think about the way in which the storyteller shapes a story to let us know what the story means. And what Auerbach is pointing out, and the essay is much richer than I've had a chance to really tell you here, but what Auerbach is pointing out is that the way the Bible tells the story tells us part of the story. That it doesn't tell us the way the characters think. It doesn't tell us most of what happens. It uses very few verbs and adjectives compared to Homer. Nothing is described. You don't know what the altar looked like. You don't know what the knife looked like. You don't know what Isaac's face looked like. You don't know what Abraham thought. I mean, any of us telling this story, if we were in a story meeting in Hollywood, you know, they would say, come back when you've written the story, because it's not there, right? And what will the viewer see on the screen? And that tells us something about what the Bible intends to do, which is, I think of it this way, the less authority you have, the more you have to explain your orders, right? If you're the boss, you say, go do this. But if you're an equal with the other person, say, would you do this? Because I think if you do this, it would help with that. The Bible doesn't explain. It's not Homer. It doesn't have to persuade you to listen. It's the Bible. It's just telling you, this is the story, and then all of us have to fill in all those many, many blanks. Yeah.
But isn't that also just the actual point of it? A person who's an author and really wants their point of view to come across, as opposed to Bible, which is allows the person to bring it into their own life.
Well, what Auerbach is saying is that both of those styles exist in Western literature. The rest of the book traces those two styles in, I mean, a ridiculously dazzling array of Western literature. He does it in medieval poems, in the Song of Roland, in various, a poem from medieval Italy. He does it in Balzac, he does it in Rabelais, he does it in Virginia Woolf. I mean, endless different ways in which he shows that some adopt the Homeric style and some adopt the biblical style. But Homer and the Bible are the paradigms. They're like the or-text, the most obvious and powerful examples of these two ways of telling a story. But you're right, we use both in our lives. Now This would be a long discussion, but one of the other schools of thought that has influenced biblical criticism a lot, and I hope I only made 50 copies, so you may have to share this, is structuralism and literary theory of various kinds, but in particular structuralism, which talks about the way in which texts are put together. And Mary Douglas, who is an anthropologist and wrote a very famous book about Leviticus many years ago, recently wrote a book about ring structures, in which she says many stories in the world that seem arbitrary or that people don't understand can be understood if you see them as rings, all right? And if that's not clear, it will be. If you will help me pass this out, I don't want to lean forward too much because then the microphone will keel over. as we go through the story of Abraham, you will see, and please take one for every two people, because I made 50 copies and I think there are more than 50 people here. You will see, yes, can you take one for, can you expedite the passing of them around? Maybe you can divide them up and have somebody hand them out or something so that we can, thanks. You can see from this chart that she has set this off as a sort of modified ring, and that it works in the following way. Okay, everybody got one? Good. The verse at the top then, if you don't have one, please seat yourself next to someone who does. The verse at the top, God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham, and he said, here I am. Okay? Now the story goes to the left. Take your son, your only son, Isaac, and offer him as a burnt offering on one of the mountains which I shall tell you. Now look at the right-hand side. The angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time and said, because you've done this and have not withheld your son, your only son, I will bless you. Now we go to verse 3 on the left. Preparations for going to the place of which God had told him, the ass, the two young men, the wood for the burnt offering. Abraham lifts up his eyes and sees the place, tells the young men to stay. Now verse 14 on the right side. God called the name of the place, God will provide. Now the left side, verse 6. Took the wood for the burnt offering, and then you go to the right, verse 13. Abraham took the ram and offered it as a burnt offering. Then you go to the left, they went on together. Isaac, father, here I am, my son. Where's the lamb? God will see to the lamb. And then the equivalent on the right, as we've spoken about before, he lifts his eyes up and he sees the ram. On the left, they came to the place of which God had told him. Abraham raises his hand to slay his son. And on the right, he's commanded, don't raise your hand. And then on the very bottom, verse 11, is the angel of the Lord called him from heaven, and he said, here I am. So what you see is that she's divided this up so that it becomes a circle. And if you put that together with Auerbach's analysis of this, what this tells us, which is very powerful and important, is that there's no such thing in a great literary work as, oh, they're just telling a story. It's conscious, it's patterned, it's thoughtful, and therefore, when people say, you know, how can you grant all these different kinds of interpretations to it, the answer in part is that you can't exhaust interpretations of a great literary work, because not only are there conscious patterns, but there are even unconscious patterns that find their way into it. And this, I mean, I don't think anybody has laid this out in the intervening, what, 2,500 years that people have been reading this story until Mary Douglas. Even though, by the way, this has been done with other stories in the Bible. And she does it in her book with other stories, from mostly Western literature, though not entirely Western literature. Her name is Mary Douglas, D-O-U-G-L-A-S. The name of the book escapes me for a second. I have it upstairs. It's a very thin book. But you can look up Mary Douglas on Amazon, and it has Ring in the title. So she did, by the way, most of her work, as I said, on Leviticus, and on boundaries. She's the one who developed the theory, which is a fascinating theory of kashrut. She was the one who developed the theory, though she is not Jewish, by the way, that the motivation behind kashrut was a boundary motivation. That why can't you eat the pure animal, she said, the way God created animals, is an animal that has split hooves and chews its cud. Anything that's not that is not a pure mammal and therefore shouldn't be eaten. Anything that's a pure fish is something with fins and scales. A lobster is sort of a land animal and a fish animal. A crab is sort of a land animal and a fish animal. And anything, she said, that's boundary blurring is not kosher. Only things that are exactly what they are. Because that gives you the sense of God's, the purity and cleanness of God's creation, and human beings aren't allowed to muddle creation. And she said that fits very well with the Jewish traditions and the Bible. She's talking about insistence on distinctions, right? That's what Havdalah is all about, between light and dark, day and night, sacred and profane. And that's the way, she says, if you read the creation story, that's what God is doing. God divides the light from the darkness. It's all a process of division and distinction, and the kashrut is more of that process. She may be right, she may be wrong, but this is the same person. Fascinating theory. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yes, Ron.
What about the genetically
altered plants of today? There are those who would argue against it, but not, but remember, what her, right, exactly. She said, we don't have them in our house. But what about genetically altered plants? Her comment is not a halachic comment. It's an anthropological comment. From the point of view of halacha, the questions are different, whether you can eat those. Although there are people who, I mean, remember, you're not supposed to mix seeds. So there are people who would judge that as a mixed seed. If it falls under that category, then it's not permitted. But it gets more complicated because there's something called davar chadash, which means that something undergoes so much modification that it's no longer what it was originally. So let's leave that aside for the moment. Okay. So all of this is some of the literary analysis that I wanted to bring to your attention about the story. And now, as one of the... Well, you know what? No, I will go through now six interpretations, very briefly, of the Akedah. And then a couple more comments on it, and then next time we'll wrap up the philosophy of the Akedah, and also, if we don't get it to it today, we'll go through the theory that Abraham knew all along that God was going to stop him. All right. One thing that you see is that the name of the mountain You know, it's called Adonai Yireh. This is, we're now in chapter 22 and verse 14. Abraham comes to that name, that site, Adonai Yireh, whence the present saying, on the mount of the Lord there is vision, right? That's what the mountain is called. Now that could be translated, Adonai Yireh, as God will see, God will provide, or even God lets himself be seen. And by the way, throughout the Bible, several times, God allows himself to be seen. We don't think of God as visible, but the Bible, if you just read the Bible, you wouldn't know that God wasn't visible, right? There are a couple times when God is seen in the Bible, and that's an interesting separate subject, but I do want to mention it. And what you find is that the idea of vision and seeing is one of the motifs that runs its way through the story, because remember, Abraham sees the mountain from afar, and then he lifts his eyes up and he sees the ram. And so there is clearly a motif of changing Abraham's vision and thereby changing the vision of the people who go after him. And that idea is especially reinforced later on when Isaac doesn't have vision. Remember, Isaac accidentally gives the birthright to Jacob instead of Esau, but on a deeper level, Isaac sees right, because Jacob is the one who's supposed to have the birthright. Again, back in Homer, in Greek literature, if any of you ever read Oedipus, right? What happens in Oedipus? There's a Tiresias, who is the blind seer, who is the one who knows what's going to happen, because the blind person is the one who really sees. And what happens to Oedipus at the end of the play? He's blinded, right? When is he blinded? When he knows the truth. In other words, when he really sees. And that same play of vision and blindness, of seeing and not seeing, exists in the Akedah as well. I want to read you a passage from right here. Okay. You know the famous passage from Micah. He has told you, O man, what is good and what the Lord requires of you, only to do justice, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. Right? Rabbis always quote that. But you know what comes right before that? With what shall I approach the Lord? Do homage to God on high. Should I approach him with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? Would the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, with streams of oil? Should I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for my sins? That idea that God wants the firstborn is a very powerful idea and exists to this day, right? Remember, we do the redemption of the firstborn before the Exodus. So, especially, and I'll talk a little bit more about this in a minute, John Levinson wrote a book called The Death and Resurrection of the Beloved Son, in which he traces through the Bible both condemnations of human sacrifice and also comments that suggest how common human sacrifice once was. That a prophet of Israel would even ask, does God want my firstborn, tells you that he came out against a background where people did that all the time, and that there was both a resistance to it and an attraction to it. Because if you really love God, then you have to give up what is most precious. And what's most precious? So here are some competing theories I don't know what to go with first. All right, here we go. The atonement interpretation. This is, and all of these are divided up by a man named Lewis Berman, who wrote a book called The Akedah, in which the whole book is about different interpretations of the Akedah. You think this has been a lot of classes on one story. It's nothing compared to... The atonement interpretation is that the Akedah was to atone for kicking Hagar and Ishmael out of the house, right? That we've spoken about. There's the martyrdom interpretation, which... Again, remember I told you that Sholem Spiegel wrote a book about how many Jews used the Akedah when they martyred themselves in the Middle Ages. There's this idea that sacrificing yourself is the ultimate sign of sacrifice to God. And and Isaac here becomes the martyr along with Abraham. Why it's the test of Abraham, we'll get back to. There is the interpretation, obviously, of Christian authors that it's a prefiguration of Jesus. The interpretation that it's a triumph of love over duty, that is, love of both Isaac and God, because you've got to believe that Abraham does this with Isaac out of love, not out of hatred. Remember, we read that in Kierkegaard last time, those of you who were here. The human life is sacred interpretation, that is that the whole point of the Akedah is to affirm that God does not take human sacrifice. And then the idea that some disaster preceded the Akedah, and this is the atonement for it, because it says sometime after these things. So some biblical scholars say that something is missing here, something terrible happened before. All of these interpretations depend on the idea that the Akedah has a good explanation. And I bring that up because, you know, I was at the, and I don't know if I mentioned this, I was at the Los Angeles Times Book Fair. And I was on the panel, I watched the panel that Christopher Hitchens was on, and among the things that he spoke about how when he was giving a rant about how terrible religion was, he mentioned the Akedah. And who would think that it was a good thing to take your son out to sacrifice him? And this is not a new criticism. In his book, Encounters Between Judaism and Modern Philosophy, Emil Fackenheim has a chapter on the Akedah in which he records two very powerful philosophical objections. Okay. The first is, what if Abraham was wrong? What if he didn't hear God's voice? What if it was a delusion? Can you sacrifice another human being based on a delusion? Okay. And the other objection is the objection of Immanuel Kant. Kant says a moral law to be valid has to be universalizable. In other words, you have to wish that everybody in your situation would act that way at that time. If not, it's not a moral law. If you say, well, I'm going to do this, but I hope nobody else does, then it's not a moral law. This gets you into trouble with Kant because he says, for example, lying is a universalizable moral law. And of course, people object. What if someone says to you, where did that guy go? Because I want to kill him. Should you tell the truth? I mean, according to Kant's strict strictures, you should. But anyway, we won't get into the problems with Kant's moral theory. But it does pose a problem for the Akedah, because the whole point of the Akedah is that Abraham is an exception. And you can't build a moral theory around exceptions, or you don't have a moral theory. Right? In fact, it's very destructive of morality to have some people for whom morality applies and other people for whom morality doesn't apply. This was Nietzsche's claim that there were Übermenschen, that there were some people for whom the normal rules would not apply. And it was a short step from Nietzsche to the Nazis. So Fackenheim takes this up, and the first objection, the objection about did Abraham know, this is an objection of faith. You've got to assume that a great prophet knows when God is speaking to him. But this already raises the second objection, which is you got to know that Abraham is a great prophet, but that's not universalizable to anybody else. And the question is, can a tradition have a moral theory in which everybody is not the same? Now, I don't have an easy answer for that, but realize that as we were discussing this, everybody assumed that they wouldn't act this way, but that somehow it must be all right for Abraham to act this way, right? That's the general assumption of people who approach the Bible in anything other than a spirit of seeking to criticize the story. But that's problematic from the point of view of a moral theory. You realize that. So having said that, let's look at the ways in which modern thinkers try to rescue Abraham from this. First of all, I mentioned once before, but I will mention it again. Michael Lerner says that what Abraham is illustrating is that everybody hears more than one voice at the same time. He heard the voice to sacrifice and not to sacrifice. And that that dual voice exists in all of us. And in the end, what voice does Abraham obey? The voice not to sacrifice. Because once you take this out of God said to him and you put it inside Abraham, then you think of this as an internal drama. For some reason, Abraham, because of his society, because of his own experience, Abraham has this very powerful impulse to sacrifice Isaac. And warring within him is sacrifice and don't sacrifice. And in the end, don't sacrifice wins. And that's the message of the story. It's a very different way of reading the Akedah, but it's very powerful if you take God out of the picture in a way and you make this just Abraham's internal drama, then it becomes a fascinating study on a very different plane, not a theological plane, but a psychological plane. Yeah.
Not to take this too far afield, but what you said something reminded me of Quakerism, and the idea that God speaks to you through your own.
Right. Yeah, there is that theory. The theory does exist actually in Judaism as well, that God speaks to you through yourself and inside yourself. The reason that Judaism is wary of it is that any legal tradition has to be very careful about how it says God speaks to people. Because if I get up next week and say, hey, guess what? God told me to have a cheeseburger on Yom Kippur. and you say, but all Jewish law says you can't, then I say, but God told me. So that's why, according to the rabbis, prophecy ended at the destruction of the temple, because they were afraid that if prophets continued, it would destroy the system. So I don't know. I mean, maybe God, that doesn't mean that people didn't say afterwards that they had messages from God, but they were it's a dangerous thing, although it hasn't proved to be particularly dangerous among Quakers, as far as I know. Here is Leibovitz's, Yeshayahu Leibovitz, and this fits very well with his general theory. I have mentioned before, Yeshayahu Leibovitz was an Israeli philosopher, a brilliant, brilliant, very irascible man. Irascible means irritable. I heard him lecture many times when I was in rabbinical school, and my year in Israel. I used to love to go listen to him lecture, as did everybody in Israel. He was the editor of the Hebrew Encyclopedia. He was mainly a scientist, but he wrote many books on Judaism, and in particular about the Rambam. He was really a Renaissance man. He was the brother of Nechama Leibovitz, who was the great modern biblical commentator. I once heard the two of them in a dialogue. It was the only time actually I heard her speak. And in the middle of the dialogue, she said something he objected to, so he turned to her and said in Hebrew, in a very scathing voice, "Who gave you a doctorate?" So that was just like him. He was very, when people would ask him questions, he was Orthodox, even though he was, scathing is not even a strong enough word. He was withering about the Orthodox establishment in Israel. He thought the fact that there was a chief rabbi was a disgrace. He thought that the fact that the ultra-Orthodox lived on welfare of the state was a disgrace, because his theory was that the state had no religious significance, none at all. He said, and because he was Orthodox, he was traditionally Orthodox, he said, there will be a messianic state of Israel one day. That will have religious significance. The reason we have a state of Israel now is because we've discovered that it's dangerous for Jews to be ruled by Goyim. That's the only reason, he said, and it is a pragmatic state and not a religious state, and therefore to get involved in the government from a religious point of view is a violation of everything that they claim they stand for. On the other hand, all those of you who like him because of that, you will not like him because he was very left-wing in his politics. And he once called the soldiers on the West Bank Nazis, for which he was lambasted all over Israel. This was a very complicated and interesting character, okay? Now, what's that? Many, many books. And some of them have been translated. You can look him up, Yeshayahu Leibovitz, Leibovitz. There's a collected essays. There's several books of his. And I have a thick Hebrew book of his biblical interpretations, and they're remarkable. Now, why do I bring this up? All of that was just background. Leibovitz's main theological thrust, and he was very influential on David Hartman, whom some of you know and some of you have studied with, who always writes about his two teachers, Soloveitchik and Leibovitz. Leibovitz's main thrust was the reason that you obey religious law is because God told you to. And any other explanation is illegitimate. If you say, I keep kosher because it reminds me who I am, he'll say, very nice, but that's not why you should keep kosher. Right? And the whole point for Leibovitz, religion was about, he was, by the way, in this way, a Kantian. Remember, I talked about Kant before. Religion was about submission to God's law and not at all about your preference. Every time in his lecture, someone would say, you know, I think, or I believe, or it seems to me, or doesn't Judaism do this, he would just blast them, you know, and say, that I understand that you feel that way because you're a pagan. That's exactly what he would say. He said, but I, as a religious Jew, it doesn't matter what I think or what I feel, it matters what the law says. I heard him say that like 1,000 times to all these shocked, you know, college students who were, he was very entertaining. You didn't want to get on his bad side, but he was very entertaining.
Is he alive? Or?
No, he died about 5 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, I think. So Leibovitz said that the Akedah is an instance of God-centered religion triumphing over anthropocentric religion. That is, it's all about God. It's not about you. God says, sacrifice your child. That is the ultimate illustration of the way in which, I mean, think about it. When he calls those people pagans, right? What would a pagan say? Right? A pagan would only do it because you're going to get something from God. The whole point is, God doesn't promise Abraham anything till after the test, not before. And he doesn't tell him you're going to get anything. He just says, do this. And he does it because, as far as Leibovitz is concerned, it's the perfect illustration. Judaism is about obedience. That's what it's about. And his fury, which you could feel like emanating in heat waves off of him, at what we think of in particular, I would say at the Judaism that is preached and practiced in a place like Sinai Temple, in which 95% of the persuasion to do Jewish things is made to an appeal to your interest and my interest, and not to God said so, is the exact reverse of what Judaism should be, right, as far as he's concerned. It doesn't matter whether it serves your interests or not. I mean, what right do we have to place our interest next to the word of the creator of the universe? So for him, the Akedah is the quintessential story of what Judaism is about. Yes?
Well, we learned in Genesis that God created man with freedom of choice and to choose between good and evil.
Of course, exactly.
God says, okay, this is good, but
that's right.
We have that.
But that's exactly his point. You must choose to obey God. If you don't, you're rebellious, you're heretical, you're a pagan. Of course you have a choice. Otherwise, you can't be obedient. Obedience implies that you're choosing, right? You're not coerced, you're obedient. So, he wouldn't disagree with you. I'm sure he would disagree with our theories about it. But that is his. Now, interestingly, his student, Hartman, says that for him, Sodom and not the Akedah is the paradigm of Abraham. Because Sodom is where Abraham argues, and the Akedah is where Abraham agrees. But let's spend at least a moment, now that we more or less have the story under our belt, about the difference between Sodom and the Akedah. Okay? The first and greatest difference, is that in Sodom, Abraham has nothing to do with it and is disinterested. Okay? And nothing is directed at him. Not only that, but in Sodom, as one of the commentators points out, God tells Abraham his plan and his rationale, and therefore opens the way for Abraham to object. That is, how often as a parent do you say, do this? And the child says, why? And you say, I just said, do this. That means there's no room for discussion. If, on the other hand, you say, do this because at 5 o'clock you have to do that, and then at 7 you have to do the other thing, what you're saying is, if you want to raise an objection to the 5 o'clock and the 7 o'clock and the do this, go right ahead. I've opened the door. At Sodom, God says to Abraham, I'm going to destroy the city because their evil has come up against me. Which is a way of saying, this is what I intend to do. I intend to do it, and this is my reason for it. That gives Abraham a chance to object. When you say, do this, and he doesn't give him a reason, and not only does he not give him a reason, it's clear there could be no good reason to sacrifice your own child, then Abraham has a choice. Objecting is not really a choice. Refusing or accepting is a choice. I mean, Abraham has, in the context of this world, Abraham has a yes or a no choice. What's he really going to say? Are you sure, God, you really want me to kill my kid? Because obviously the command is so absurd and so outrageous that it's like one of those movies where somebody knows that there's an emergency situation and the other person doesn't know it, right? And they say, jump out of this window. And the guy says, what, are you crazy? And they say, just jump. And the person knows, you know, you can't stand around and say, are you sure this window? Maybe we could go a floor below. You either do it or you don't. And it's that sort of urgency to the situation that gives the Akedah its impetus. So when you say you prefer the Abraham of Sodom, we can understand why, but I'm not sure that they're entirely comparable, except in as much as Sodom is letting you know that Abraham is not a weak person and is not afraid to challenge God if he believes that God should be challenged. And that means that he doesn't think that God should be challenged when it comes to the Akedah. Yeah.
Well, also with Akedah, he's sort of in it.
Right.
He doesn't have the...
He's not an observer.
And, you know, the detachment to say don't do this, you know, he's one of the people, so I'm not sure in that situation he could really judge.
Yes. And this is a beautiful... Michael Fishbane makes this beautiful point. Where is it? Okay. Look now at verse 17, 22:17. What is the reward for the Akedah? I will make my blessing upon you. Where is it? There are three blessings, okay? All right. Your descendants as numerous as the stars of the heavens and the sands of the sea. And they'll seize the gates of their foes, and the nations of the earth shall bless themselves by you. So you'll be prosperous and you'll be numerous, right? Fishbane says that those blessings, earth, human generativity, and human labor, success, kids, land, right? Those are the three blessings, are the reversal of the curses in the garden. What does God say to Adam? Get out of the land, by your sweat of your brow you will eat, and Eve is going to have pain in childbirth. Now, because they're the exact opposite of what Adam did. Adam, with one command, disobeyed it. Abraham, with one command, obeyed it. He gets the reverse of the Garden of Eden, and so of the curses of the garden, and so it's giving to the Israelites what was taken away from humanity. Yeah.
I just want to go back a second to the difference between the Akedah and Sodom. Couldn't it be, as opposed to Homer, where you just said that the character doesn't grow at all, couldn't it be that Abraham, after the experience of the Akedah and not arguing and just obeying, decided that, you know, hey, I don't really like being that way, and
right.
I want to have a voice.
Except Sodom was before the Akedah. It would work if it was reversed. But you could argue it that way, which is that the experience of arguing with God was so traumatic that he thought, you know, I'm not going to do that again. I don't know. And also, I don't remember if I mentioned this last time, but I may have. The Tosefet Bracha says a really, you know, he answers a very hard question very nicely. I'm not sure it's a sufficient answer, but it's a good one, which is, why is the test for Abraham? Let's turn to Isaac for a minute. Why isn't the test for Isaac? And it does seem, by the way, that Isaac doesn't object through all this. And the Tosefet Bracha's answer, which I think I mentioned last time, but deserves repeating, is Abraham is a tzaddik, the son of a rasha, right? He's a righteous man, the son of a wicked man. Isaac is a righteous man and the son of a righteous man. In other words, Isaac had what the Talmud calls girsa d'yankuta, the version of his youth. Isaac grew up with reverence. Abraham didn't. So for Abraham to obey God was going against what he had learned as a child. But for Isaac to obey God was going with what he had learned as a child. Now, it's a good answer. It's a nice answer. The other possible answer, of course, is the age of Isaac, which, according to one calculation, is older, but clearly in the story seems to be adolescent, because he's old enough to carry the wood, but he's not old enough to make a meaningful contribution to the story. Yeah.
Wasn't he so traumatized, though, that he left afterwards? It wasn't like he wasn't affected.
We have no idea. Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. We haven't gotten to, I mean, first of all, it never says so. It certainly never says he's traumatized. What we do know, we'll talk about the end of the story in a minute, but maybe he was. Yeah. Right.
And later on, Balaam, right, Donkey saw the angel with the sword, that special attribute. But yeah, the donkey is kind of interesting because later, when they come to the land after leaving Egypt, they're supposed to sacrifice the. It's the only non-kosher animal with firstborn status, but mm-hmm. it's supposed to be sacrificed for a lamb in its place or something like that. But is there anything more significant? Maybe the donkey.
The intended sacrifice? I don't know. That's a really interesting question. I haven't thought about the donkey. But the association that I had when you first said it, other than Bilam, was that the Messiah is supposed to come riding in on a donkey, according to Zechariah. So that may be where the image gets picked up, just as the shofar is supposed to. That's why Jesus rides into Jerusalem on a donkey, right? Because he's trying to fulfill the Old Testament Hebrew Bible prophecy of Zechariah that the Messiah will ride in on a donkey. That along with the ram, I mean, it becomes very symbolic, but I don't know. I'd have to look into that and see if anybody's written anything on the donkey. Right, exactly, apart from Shrek. Yes, this is, but you can't imagine that by the end of this was a donkey on the edge. Okay, let me close with two beautiful passages from, is there a last, go ahead. He did. Oh, I'm glad you said that. He got the blessings before and then he gets them again. So the commentators struggle with that. The most beautiful answer that I read was, said before he got the blessings, but they were blessings, they were gifts. Now they're earned. And blessings that are earned endure forever. That's what the commentator says. That was a nice one. All right, go ahead, Jules, and then I'll finish. We don't from the Bible. This is a rabbinic interpretation. In fact, from the Bible, if you remember the beginning of the class, not of the whole class, but at the beginning of Abraham's story, we pointed out that Terach had already left Canaan and gone all the way to Haran before the call came to Abraham in the first place. But I won't revisit that at the moment. Okay. Wiesel says he always felt closer to Isaac than to Abraham. But he does say, instead of being angry at God, which Abraham could be, he makes a deal. God says, when in the future my children and my children's children throughout the generations will act against your law and your will, you will also say nothing, as I did, and forgive them. So be it, God agreed. Let them but retell this tale, and they will be forgiven. We now begin to understand why Abraham's name is synonymous with chesed. And in fact, that is Abraham's characteristic. All the forefathers are associated with a characteristic. Abraham's is chesed. Now, here is the way that Wiesel finishes this. And in fact, you know he was recently attacked in San Francisco by some crazy. And when I wrote him about it, I ended up by quoting this back to him because it's so perfect both for that and also just in general. He says, let us return to the question we asked at the beginning. Why was the most tragic of our ancestors named Isaac, a name which evokes and signifies laughter? Here's why. as the first survivor, he had to teach us, the future survivors of Jewish history, that it's possible to suffer and despair an entire lifetime and still not give up the art of laughter. Isaac, of course, never freed himself from the traumatizing scenes that violated his youth. The Holocaust had marked him and continued to haunt him forever. Yet he remained capable of laughter, and in spite of everything, he did laugh. Okay, thank you.